We've scheduled our first pop-up stories event of 2016. Join Current State at the Mica Gallery for an evening of storytelling on the theme Change of Heart. That's 2 weeks from tonight, Mica Gallery, Old Town, 6 p.m. till 7:30. And for all the details and perhaps to join our lineup of storytellers, think about that. Visit our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. It's Current State for Thursday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Not long after the 9/11 attacks, Michigan toughened laws involving bomb threats, including making a false terror threat. Still, for years, mid-Michigan authorities had few occasions to press those charges. None happened in Ingham County between 2010 and 2013. But lately, that's changed. Ingham County prosecutors have charged residents with the crime 6 times in the past 12 months. To discuss that uptick, as well as other recent developments involving juvenile sentencing, I sat down yesterday with Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings. I first asked him what he thinks is behind the growing number of false terror threats.
I wish I knew. I'd say the majority of the complaints that we receive have been somebody, generally it's a younger person, who posts something on social media that they're going to shoot up a school district or place a bomb or something like that. The police get wind of it. They react as they're supposed to. You get schools getting locked down. They take, you know, extraordinary measures because in this day and age, you have to take these things seriously.
Apparently, it was passed in 2002 here in Michigan, part of the Michigan Anti-Terrorism Act, which was not long after 9/11. Is the law itself a good, responsible law, in your opinion?
Having had the occasion to use the law, I think that we could use 2 statutes. I think we could use 1 statute, which the one that we have, which just makes it a crime to make the threat. But I don't know that that needs to have a penalty of 20 years. And then I think we could have one where if you make a threat and have some means or you've taken some step towards carrying out the threat, that could be a 20-year. But I think that just the mere making of the threat probably should have a lesser penalty. Not a lot lesser, maybe a 10-year or something like that.
But it could possibly use some fine-tuning in your view. Let me get your response to what Dan Korobkin of the ACLU of Michigan told the State Journal, and I'll quote, "If the statute's being used to silence protests, or if it's being used to try to scare people into pleading guilty to a lesser charge, then the legislature should go back and fix it," unquote. Is he raising a legitimate concern here?
Well, the first part of that, whether it's being used to silence protests, that's never... In our experience here in Ingham County, that's never been the case. It's never come up in the context of somebody trying to protest something. I can't speak for other jurisdictions in the state. And the second part of try and get people to plead to a lesser crime, that's not true here. It's just like with any crime. Anytime we receive an investigation from a police agency, we charge the crime which is most specific to the conduct. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to ultimately seek a conviction on that charge. We may reduce the charges as we have, I think, frequently in this situation. But we have to charge what the person did, and then as we find out more, we try and do the right thing.
When it comes to deciding whether to prosecute, are these cases harder for any reason?
You always have the First Amendment issue out there, and we have to be cognizant of that. I mean, people do have freedom of speech. The state Supreme Court has said that because of the nature of the threat, it is constitutional to charge a person who just makes the threat, or whether it's a threat and the person knows it's false. But if they make the threat and it carries all the earmarks of a terrorist threat, then yes, it can be charged.
I'm talking with Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings about the increase in cases involving terror threats. We'll also get into juvenile justice and prison reform here in a few minutes. The latest development in Michigan prison reform involves a proposal in the legislature whether to redefine a juvenile in the court system as older than 18. Right now it's older than 17. A good move in your view?
I think that before we talk about the philosophy or the policy or whether this is good. We have to talk about the bunny. Who's going to pay for this? I'm the liaison from the Prosecutors Association to the Michigan Association of Counties. This is going to shift an enormous amount of money to the county. Right now, if a 17-year-old gets into the system, it's not a county cost. It's not a local cost. If this law were to pass, then that would be an enormous shift of financial burden to the counties and other localities. For instance, in Ingham County, a caseworker, a juvenile case officer, is only allowed to have 20 cases. We charged 250 17-year-olds last year. If all of those ended up in the juvenile system, they'd have to hire another 12 or 13 juvenile court officers. Plus, the programming that you have for 17-year-olds, how much longer are they going to be in the system? Because, you know, they end up going out at 19. And a lot of these 17-year-olds have already been involved in the juvenile justice system and have had the programming that's available to them. The word that was used to me was that a lot of 17-year-olds are already criminogenic, which means that they sort of have passed through the juvenile system and they've moved on into a higher form of crime. And that the programs that the juvenile system has available to them really isn't appropriate for the 17-year-old population. So if it is their first adult crime, there are programs such as the Homeless Youthful Trainee Act or 7411, or if it's a domestic 76948, all of those things I just mentioned essentially put the person on probation, and if they successfully complete the probation, they have no adult criminal history for that crime. So we do have things in place to deal with them. Another thing we have to consider is we have 24 beds in the Ingham County Youth Home. Our youth home is always filled to capacity. So if we take these 17-year-olds, are we going to move them in there and move these other people out? And I don't think they really want these 17-year-olds in there with 13, 14, 15-year-olds. You know, our goal in the Prosecutors Association is to try and make a person's first touch with the criminal justice system their last touch. And to divert resources in the juvenile justice system, the limited resources of the juvenile justice system, from those 13, 14, 15-year-olds who are maybe just having their first brush with the system to 17-year-olds who've already had the benefit of some programming, I think we're going to reduce the ability to really try and make a difference with those 13, 14, and 15-year-olds. So I'm just talking about the finances and the money.
If the money were not an issue, would you think it was a good move?
I don't know, because I've never gotten past the money thing. I understand that the people, if we talk about why juveniles, 17-year-olds, should not be given mandatory life sentences without parole, because there's been a lot of science that has talked about how, you know, the 17-year-old brain, how these kids, you know, they're not really fully responsible. They're not adults. Their brain is still growing. They have impulse control problems, that children are different than adults. So I understand that philosophy. But on the other hand, you know, if you have a crime victim, and I deal with crime victims, and I think that their perspective, their voices have not really been heard in this conversation.
Critics of reform, victims' rights groups, still say if you commit a truly heinous crime, a capital felony at 17, you deserve to serve the time.
Well, whether that should be life in prison without the possibility of parole henceforth, I'll leave that up to the policymakers. But we have a group of people in the state, citizens, who effectively got a promise from the state that this person that killed your loved one is going to prison for life without parole. And now we have to go back to these people and tell them, sorry, but that which you relied upon is not going to happen. And that's devastating for some of these people.
That dovetails right into last month's Supreme Court ruling that the ban on automatic life sentences without parole for juveniles should be retroactive. That means over 2,000 juvenile murderers now have a chance at parole.
Well, they're going to be resentenced. What happened after the Miller versus Alabama decision, which is the first decision that said you cannot have a mandatory life without parole for a juvenile. After that, the Michigan State Legislature passed a bill that said in the event the state Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court decides this will be applied retroactively, then they set forth a procedure for dealing with that. Their procedure is not to have parole go before the parole board for review. The procedure they set forth is to come have the individual come back for a resentencing before the trial judge or that judge's successor.
Now, have you prosecuted many cases that resulted in a life sentence for a person younger than 17?
We have two that fall within the category that have to be reviewed, and I am in the process of reviewing those trial transcripts to decide if we are going to ask for a hearing to have them resentenced to life without parole, or if we're going to just, you know, allow the court to resentence. The way it works is if the prosecutor does not request that hearing, then they come back and they can be sentenced, I think it's 25 to 60 years.
Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings there. Hear more of our discussion on Monday when we'll talk about what he learned from his late father, groundbreaking Lansing attorney Stuart Dunnings.
It doesn't cost you anything to be nice to people, and oftentimes it pays off in great rewards.
Hear that Monday here on Current State. Coming up on today's program, many are asking why media weren't more on top of the Flint water crisis. Part of it might have to do with the fact that Michigan exempts both the governor and the legislature from Freedom of Information Act requests. We talked to Ron Zwankowski, columnist for the Detroit Free Press and board member of the Michigan Council for Open Government, about the cloudiness of Michigan's sunshine laws. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for being with us today. In 1850, the United States passed the controversial Fugitive Slave Act. It required that escaped slaves who were captured be returned to their masters, even if they had made it to a free state. Slave catchers were brutal in their pursuit of slaves who had escaped their masters, and they weren't above capturing free black people, too. And so, many African Americans in the North carried with them the papers proving they had bought or been given their freedom. Now, few of these documents have survived, but recently the Michigan Historical Archives unveiled a restored version of the manumission papers of a Mason man named Frank Demas. Here to tell us more about the significance of this document is Michigan State Archivist Mark Harvey. Welcome to Current State, Mark.
Thank you.
Also with us, Benjamin Hall, the great-great-great-grandson of Mr. Demas. Welcome to Current State, Ben.
Thank you.
This document was passed down to people in your family for generations. Why did you decide to give it to the Archives of Michigan?
Well, I guess first of all, it was time. And second of all, it had been sitting, well, since the late 80s in my father's safe in the original canister that I assume Frank Demas carried it around in.
Mm.
So it's amazing that it survived in as good a shape that it did.
Did you know a lot about Frank Demas growing up? I mean, was this something your family talked about?
A bit. My family has been kind of of biracial ethnicity going back that far, and some of us have embraced the African American side of our heritage, and some have not. I would say that my father had not, and we kept the history alive just to know where we came from, but as far as embracing the importance to black people of this of the manumission, maybe not so much.
Mark, how special is this document? Are there a lot of manumission papers in the state archives?
There's now one, so it's very special. Yeah,
this is the first.
One of our very early collections, there's a copy of one, or a copy of a part of one, but and it's not for a free black. It's for an indentured servant, so it's not the same type of record. So this is the one that we have, and so it's special for a number of reasons,
pretty
including its scarcity. But that's probably the least of the reasons why it's important.
What does the document tell us about Frank Demas's life?
Well, it's been interesting since Ben donated it 2 years ago, and it's taken us that long to go through the process of getting it restored and conserved. So we just got it back this past Monday, February 1st. So we're learning quite a bit about the document now that it's actually been unrolled. I think Ben said he never actually fully unrolled it during the time.
I was afraid to. I just didn't want to. I mean, I knew how old it was. I didn't want to compromise it at all.
Ben, how much have you learned then about your ancestors since you started looking into your family history?
A lot. I've had a chance to trace, you know, all the way back, and I found out Mary, Frank's wife's mother's name, but that's as far back as it goes. So I've traced them back to Kentucky, where they were both slaves. But I mean, I've found out a lot about my family's history in this city, which is very interesting. You know, finding out that we were one of the first black families in town, finding out that my family has had kind of a relationship with the Littles, Malcolm X's family, going all the way back to that time. It's been quite a journey. I found out a lot of very, very interesting stuff.
When did your ancestors first arrive in Lansing then?
1870? It wasn't that late.
Earlier than that, somewhere in the early 1860s. It's hard to pinpoint with census records because they usually leave a gap of 10 years.
Okay.
So from what we found, they Frank and Mary fled into Canada at some point between 1857 and 1860, and then they make their way back by way of Lenawee County, which is where the abolitionist Laura Haviland was working with the Underground Railroad. And so, and then some point, late 1860s, around 1870, they make their way to Vevey Township, which is near Mason.
Nearby, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Frank Demas was also known as Thomas Willis for a while. What do we know about that name change and the other name?
Well, I've actually found even more out within the last week, but his wife was an escaped slave. He helped her escape, and they fled north. And when they finally settled in Lansing, in order for her slave master to not be able to find her, they changed their name, their last name. And I found out from another Willis that lives in the Detroit area that he believes that they changed their last name to Willis because they stopped over for a brief time in Willis, Michigan, which was one of the first black settlements in Michigan.
Willis, Michigan. I've never heard of Willis, Michigan.
I hadn't either.
Well, is there still a Willis, Michigan?
I believe, and check my geography, but if you're traveling south on US 23, you go by Willis Road. It's just on an exit south of Ann Arbor, and that would be the area where.
So it may have been a road, and they just called it
Willis.
Yeah,
it was probably
Willis,
a small town.
Michigan.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but it would have been on that path coming from Lenawee County, too, so that all makes sense.
We're talking with Michigan State Archivist Mark Harvey, also to Ben Hall, who recently donated the manumission papers of his great-great-great-grandfather to the Archives of Michigan. The document spent a lot of time rolled up in a tube. You referred to the restoration process. What did that take? What was that like?
Well, we actually didn't conduct the restoration. It's more a scientific chemical process, so it's a specialization that we took our time contracting with the right firm.
Who does that? And
not many people.
Do you understand?
We wound up contracting with a firm in Detroit called Rivers Preservation and Conservation. So their sole business purpose is to restore documents like this. And this is a special document because when we say the word document, we think paper. This is a type of parchment called vellum, which is made
animal
of calf
skin.
Yeah, it's calf skin specifically. So, I mean, there's a whole set of chemical parameters that need to be addressed when you're dealing with something like that. So, yes, it was rolled. The good thing is that official documents were put on that type of material because they last a long time taking care of it the right way. Mm-hmm. So it's actually in really good condition.
Ben, what was it like to finally see that document rolled out flat in front of you like a proper document instead of imagining what it was like rolled up inside that canister?
It was a very emotional experience. You know, actually taking the time to read through it. I had in Mary's obituary, she died at, 97 years old? There was a full-page obituary of her in the local newspaper. And they transcribed word for word what the Freedom Papers said. So I had a chance to read through them then. But, actually seeing the handwriting and the signatures of everyone and the real color of the ink, which came out after the restoration process, it was very...
Yeah.
She died when, then?
It was in the...
1907.
1907, yeah.
How will people be able to see Frank Demas's manumission papers, Mark?
Well, it's on display right now at the Archives of Michigan. So because this isn't the typical path of a donation, but because of its importance, we have a small exhibit area in the entrance to the Archives of Michigan at the Michigan Historical Center. So it's on exhibit as we speak, and it will be there for some time. We haven't quite determined how long. And then long term, as the Michigan Historical Museum, which is our partner agency, moves to restore its 19th century exhibits, we will figure out a way to include that in our principal galleries permanently.
Ben, what do you want people who come to see this document to take away from it?
Well, I guess there's a few things. I mean, first of all, just looking at it and realizing what it took for Frank and Mary to get here. I mean, that I've actually had cousins reach out to me within the last couple of days that I didn't even know of. And
this story is still unfolding.
It is, very much so.
How about that?
And how far we've come and how far we have to go. And also, it really puts into perspective the sacrifice of escaped slaves. I mean, just thinking about, them hiding out and people's earthen basements or whatever to try to get here. I mean, and they have generations of, great, great, great grandchildren out there. So I hope that people, something that the head of the archives had said was that they want everyone to come in and find a piece of themselves in the museum. And I hope that someone comes in and finds a piece of themselves in the manumission.
We've been talking about the archives' recent restoration of the manumission papers of Mason resident Frank Demas. Our guests today have been Michigan State Archivist Mark Harvey and Ben Hall, Demas's great, great, great grandson. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up on Current State, we'll visit the Grand Rapids Art Museum for a preview of their Valentine's Day tie-in, Art Plus Chocolate. Gotta love it. This is the third year of an exploration of the color red and how it's used in various displays throughout the museum. But the kicker is what the Grand Rapids Art Museum gives you at the end of the tour. Hang on for that. That and more coming up after the break. Smith there playing a song called Always I Know on a Current State Live Music Friday last year. Tomorrow we get into the Valentine's mood here in Studio S with live love songs from singer Evangeline. We hope you can join us on Live Music Friday. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. In his State of the State address this January, Governor Rick Snyder announced he was releasing all of his emails from 2014 and 2015 related to the Flint water crisis.
So you will have answers to your questions about what we've done and what we're doing to make this right for the families of Flint. Anyone will be able to read this information for themselves. at michigan.gov/Snyder. Because the most important thing we can do right now is to work hard and work together for the people of Flint.
But he didn't have to do that. Michigan is one of only two states that exempts the governor's office from Freedom of Information Act requests. And many journalists say the state's weak public records laws put a wrench in media's efforts to find the truth about the Flint water crisis. Here to talk about how the crisis is shaping the conversation about government transparency in the state is Ron Zwankowski, longtime columnist at the Detroit Free Press and a board member of the Michigan Council for Open Government. Ron, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having us.
A recent report from the Center for Public Integrity ranked Michigan last in the nation when it comes to government transparency. Why?
Well, because there is nothing in state law that compels government officials to be open and accountable in two of the three branches of government, that is the executive and the legislative branches. Both of those are exempt from requests made under the Freedom of Information Act under the 1976 law that was passed in Michigan. It was written with an exemption for the governor, and then a subsequent attorney general's opinion sometime in the 80s said that that exemption should extend to the legislature as well. Further, the state elected officials have also over the years made it far more difficult for the public to get timely information about who's contributing to campaigns and how much money. Most of that information is not available to the public until after an election, so it's difficult for the public to find out who's bankrolling various officials or who's paying for various political ads. So on that basis, the Center for Public Integrity, which does an annual data-driven study, gave Michigan an F grade, ranked us dead last among the 50 states, and pointed out that this is a concern because it creates a climate that invites corruption. And that's not to suggest that there's any terrible corruption going on in Lansing right now, but the possibility of corruption is always there when you don't have an open government that must at some point be accountable to the public.
In addition to being one of the most opaque state governments, Michigan also earned the dubious honor of having the fewest ethical safeguards for government. What kind of problems does that create?
Well, I think, it's human nature that we all behave differently, and generally I would suggest that we all behave better when we think that we're being watched or we know that there is a possibility of being watched. It's no accident that video cameras are popping up all over the place these days because they tend to keep people on their better behavior. And so I think if you knew that as a public official, the decisions you made, the correspondence that you had, the emails that you exchanged, the minutes of meetings that you attended, that invitations, in fact, to those meetings, all of that had to, at some point, be accessible to the public, I think it would change the way you behave. And I would suggest that it would make you behave for the better, that your own interests might take a back seat to the interests of the public that you were elected to serve.
What role do you think the lack of government transparency played in the Flint crisis?
Well, I don't think it's an accident that most of what we know about the situation in Flint was exposed by journalists or by public information groups exercising what limited availability they have under the Freedom of Information Act. Very little of the bad news out of Flint was initially reported or distributed by government agencies involved. It was reported by the media, by public interest groups, and then government agencies reacted to those disclosures. So when government does things wrong, as is clearly the case in Flint, government is not likely to volunteer that information. And I think you're seeing, just this past week, reports in both the Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press, some other sources indicated that further information about when and who knew about the prospects or the increasing numbers of Legionnaires' disease cases in the Flint area, that is just coming to light, and what efforts were made to respond or conceal reaction to that. And so I think you have a situation where the government is continuing to not be forthcoming with information about what's going on in Flint, and you have journalists and public interest groups that have to continue to dig out the information and make it public.
Ron Zwankowski is a longtime columnist at the Detroit Free Press and a board member of the Michigan Council for Open Government. We're talking about how the lack of transparency about the lack of transparency in Michigan's state government. I want to talk again about Governor Snyder's promise to release his 2014 and 2015 emails and how that may have related to the Flint water crisis. There have been a lot of Democrats who've criticized this as not being enough. Do you think the governor is making a good faith effort at transparency?
You know, I can't be sure. I would like to think so. I'd like to think that he's a man of his word, that he released, I believe it was 274 or so pages of emails. But there is nothing in the law that would enable me to find out if that's all the emails that were exchanged with the administration. I do know that there is a legislator from the Flint area who says that sometime around January, I believe, of 2015, he had correspondence with the governor about the water situation in Flint, and that that correspondence was not included in the governor's email. So perhaps the governor released what he thought were all of his emails, but we don't have any way of verifying that. And he's indicated that he would be supportive of ending the exemption for the governor's office from the Freedom of Information Act. But I have real doubts that this legislature is ever going to send that bill to his desk.
Freedom of information requests are a really critical tool in a reporter's arsenal here. As a journalist who's been working in Michigan for a long time, how have news organizations had to adapt to working in a state with such exemptions for FOIAs of state government?
I think in my 40 years in journalism in the state, what has tended to be practice is that reporters build relationships and develop sources which provide more information than what you can get, or in a more timely way than what you can get under the Freedom of Information Act, which can be both cumbersome and expensive. Now, to the governor's credit, last year he did sign a bill, the first significant reforms in the Freedom of Information Act in its history, that set a more reasonable fee schedule and set more timing restraints on government officials to respond to requests under FOIA. But in my experience, the stories that I've been involved in, and I'm thinking just off the top of my head of the resignation of the former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, that information was revealed by sources based on relationships cultivated by reporters rather than information that came available through the Freedom of Information Act. Now, that's not to suggest that the Free Press, where I worked for a long time, didn't use FOIA, but I think we also knew that FOIA would be, in many cases, a more cumbersome way to pursue information than trying to get it through, shall we say, a journalistic back door.
There's been a renewed discussion here now about changing the public records laws in the wake of the water crisis. How likely is it, do you think, that those efforts will make it through the state legislature? Could Flint be the straw that breaks the proverbial camel's back here?
I would like to think that if something good is to come out of something bad, which is sometimes the best thing you can hope for in a political situation, that the something good may be a renewed commitment to openness in government, especially in Lansing. But as somebody who covered the state capitol and had a lot of exchanges with legislators over the years, I can also tell you that they're a pretty self-serving bunch. And they've got a very nice loophole here that enables much of what they do to remain out of the public eye. So I guess I'm cynical enough over the years to think that it's very unlikely that this legislature is going to do anything more to make itself accessible and accountable to the public. I would like to think that they'd send a bill that's now pending to end the exemptions for the legislative and executive branches from FOIA. I'd like to think they'd send that bill to Snyder, and I'd like to think that he'd sign it. But I guess I'm more of a political realist than that. I just don't think it's going to happen, even with the Flint disaster in their faces.
Are there states that have good government transparency policies?
Well, the state that always was the one that we in Michigan sort of envied was Florida. It is the Sunshine State, I think, in more ways than one. It is among the states that was the first in the nation to make, for instance, courtrooms open and accessible to the public by allowing TV cameras in courtrooms. And Florida has always been a state with a strong commitment, I think, to what we call sunshine, that is open government, and also among the first states to take a lot of public information and make that available online, which can, of course, save not just journalists, but the public, can save the public a lot of time and effort in obtaining information. So Florida is always the state that we look to, although I should add that in the latest Center for Public Integrity report, Florida, they ranked Florida just ahead of Michigan. Michigan got an F grade. Florida was a D. And I think the states that they looked upon most favorably were California, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island got the only sort of passing grades, I guess, in their assessment. Mm.
Ron Zwankowski is a longtime columnist at the Detroit Free Press and board member of the Michigan Council for Open Government. We've been talking about how Michigan's weak public record laws limit government transparency here in the state. Ron, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's safe to say there's no more distinguished jazz pianist on the planet today than Kenny Barron. For the past half century, Barron's been collaborating with all of the world's major jazz figures, making hundreds of records and educating the next creators of the art form. Kenny Barron is in residence with the Michigan College of Music this week, performing and instructing on campus and across the state. He very generously took a major portion of his Tuesday this week to come to WKAR for music and conversation with current state Scott Pohl. Before Scott caught up with the many goings-on in Kenny Barron's musical life, Barron started in right at the keyboard.
Usually when you start a program, you start with something upbeat. This is a very, I think, a very beautiful ballad that I wrote, and it was actually recorded on a record I did with Dave Holland, a duo recording. So I think sometimes it's nice to start relaxed and calm.
Kenny Barron with Rain. Kenny Barron, the MSU College of Music has a really busy schedule for you while you're in residence here in East Lansing. Rehearsals and workshops with MSU students, visits to places like Oxford High School, East Lansing High School, Williamston Middle School, the Cook Recital Hall in the MSU Music Building, the First Presbyterian Church of Hastings, and the Carr Center in Detroit. I wanted to give you a chance, though, to talk more about the time you're going to spend in residency here at MSU. What are your plans?
Well, I'll be doing workshops and clinics and with the young students, workshops about jazz improv, working with some of the young high school ensembles, things like that.
Now, you taught for more than two decades at Rutgers University, and now you're working at the Juilliard School in New York. What inspired you to get into teaching? What do you like about teaching young musicians?
Well, first of all, it's a way to help perpetuate the music. And then I learned from them as well, you know, especially now teaching at Juilliard. The students are really incredible, a little bit scary sometimes. And they're so good, you know. So I get to learn. I get to give back. So it's a great experience.
All right. Well, Kenny Barron, we want to hear some more music. That's the big reason we have you here, of course. So the next song you've selected is a standard called Love Walked In. Lots of people will be familiar with Love Walked In. Why is this on your list today?
Well, it's one of my favorite songs. I first heard it as I was early teens. And my sister actually had a record by Dave Brubeck called Jazz Goes to College. And that was one of the songs on there. And I was smitten by it. I fell in love with it.
Love Walked In. Here's Kenny Barron. Love get back to a question that's related to teaching again. You brought up how you learn from the young musicians. Go into greater detail on that. What can someone with your decades of experience learn from working with youngsters?
Well, I think, first of all, the young people today are much better prepared than I was at their age. So they have a lot they can teach me. I mean, in terms of technique, in terms of their harmonic concept. Plus, they've been through academia, and that's one of the things that helps them be better prepared.
Your own academic experience was interesting in that regard. You went back to school at some point in your life.
I went back to school, I guess, in the 70s. You know, first got an associate's degree at Manhattan Community College, and then I got a bachelor's degree from the State University of New York.
And Why did you go back to school, though? What inspired you to do that?
Well, interestingly enough, it was through the encouragement of a Detroit musician. I worked with Yusef Lateef, and he was very much into self-improvement and forging ahead. So he encouraged me to go back to school, and I did.
And it worked?
And it worked.
How do you know when a student has what it takes to advance to a career in performing or teaching or both?
Well, in terms of performing, you can assess that. I mean, it doesn't take that long to feel if somebody has to hear if somebody has the right feeling for the music. That's important. That's the one thing I can't give anybody. That's one thing they have to come to the table with. The other stuff you can teach, like I said, raw materials. This is what you do over this chord, or you use this scale. That's raw material. You can teach that. But certain kinds of things you can't teach, like feeling, swing, the essence of swing, you can't teach that. They have to feel that already, you know, so.
At a place like Juilliard, are you working primarily or exclusively with pianists?
Well, not exclusively, but primarily. I have three piano students. And then I also help to coach an ensemble, which is called the Artist Diploma Group. And they're just about professional. They work, and that particular group, they don't pay tuition, so they're used as outreach. They go out to various colleges and performance centers, and they actually help recruit students to come to Juilliard.
We want to hear some more music. Here's Kenny Barron. The next song you've chosen is "Embraceable You."
Another one of my perennial favorites. My sweet "Embraceable You."
Well, Kenny Barron, it's been an exceptional thrill having you here at WKAR and at the MSU College of Music all week long. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Pianist Kenny Barron with WKAR Scott Pohl there. Now, in addition to his many activities with students around MSU and across the state this week, Kenny Barron performs tomorrow night at 7 and at 9:30 at Cook Recital Hall as part of the MSU Federal Credit Union Jazz Artist in Residence program. Well, if you haven't made Valentine's Day plans for you and your sweetie yet, the clock is ticking. Valentine's Day is Sunday. And second, Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now with a weekend alternative. So you've got an excursion for us? To where, Jamie?
Oh, up to Grand Rapids Art Museum, or GRAM. And this is the third year of what they're calling Art Plus Chocolate. And by the way, according to Andrea Morgan, who organizes the museum docent program at GRAM, it's not just for couples only on that so-called Singles Awareness Day. That's the other name people know it as. Andrea suggests singles go to mingle a bit and use the opportunity to talk about art and let things progress as they will when discussing this unifying theme of Art Plus Chocolate on Saturday.
Basically, the idea of what I was thinking about is when we think about Valentine's Day and love, we tend to think about the color red. And artists use the color red in a very particular way. And so I thought it would be sort of fun for Valentine's Day weekend for us to take a look at a couple of works of art that employ the color red in interesting ways. And then at the end of the tour, everybody gets chocolate. So it's kind of a fun little play on works works of art. So what we're looking at right now is Jennifer Bartlett's Small House. And in this work of art, we are seeing a large landscape with a single shape in the middle. Now, as we're looking at this shape, it to us kind of looks like a house, but we'll notice that it is just two simple shapes put together. We have a rectangle and a triangle, and the rectangle is red. This is the only red in the entire composition. And so as we look at it, I like to kind of ask the question of, what draws our eyes first? So I'll ask you, what draws your eye as you're looking at this first?
For me, because I like to look at big picture, I see the 81 squares, and I'm like, okay, it's right in the center.
Mm-hmm. And this is a play on pointillism. So Jennifer Bartlett was working on this piece in the late 90s. But if we think back to kind of classic pointillism and George Seurat, we have these very pure dots of color. And right now we're standing pretty far away from it, but if we move close to it, you can see that the red is just a very small percentage of the overall composition. And that's because being such a bold and powerful color, you only need a teeny tiny bit of red to balance out a huge amount of these cool colors, the greens and the blues. So in this work, when Jennifer Bartlett just put this one square of red dead in the center, she balanced out this entire composition of red.
For Art Plus Chocolate, is this going to be a curated tour as well for people to come themselves?
The way that the tours work at Graham is that our docents are highly trained individuals, and they each pick which works of art they're going to talk about. So we have three tours, and it's going to be led by three different docents, and each docent will pick which works of art that they want to talk about. They will all be talking around this main theme of the color red and how artists use that color, but it's a different experience depending on which tour you go on and which docent you're with. And the way that my docents are trained is to really let the guests kind of guide the conversation. So don't expect to come to the art museum and just have someone stand in front of a work of art and talk at you for an hour. It really is about making your own personal meaning with a work of art. So the docent is there to kind of facilitate the conversation, give some background information, but at the end of the day, what we're looking for is for each person to walk away with their own ideas about art, and really that's the most fun thing to me, is to hear what other people have to say about the works. People really seem to enjoy it. It has sold out every year in the past. So this year we actually added two more time slots because it was so popular last year and the year before that we're just really hoping that people come out and have a good time and make Graham part of their Valentine's Day.
And there is a discount for those that are members, yes?
There is, yes. Members are $8 and non-members are $10. And we really hope that people register ahead of time because I can't guarantee that there will be slots left on the day. We do limit the number of people on a tour simply because it's impossible to drag 30 people through the museum and for everybody to have a good experience. So we do try to limit it to about 10 to 15 people per tour. And slots are selling pretty quickly right now. So if you're interested, please go to our website and you can register for the tour.
Art Plus Chocolate, Seeing Red, is at the Grand Rapids Art Museum this Saturday with three tours throughout the day. More information and registration is online at artmuseumgr.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Glad you could join us. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, the Lansing Board of Water and Light is assisting in Flint's water emergency. The utility is offering help replacing lead pipes, along with many insights gained from years of replacing lead pipes here in the Lansing area. We'll learn more from BWL General Manager Dick Peffley and Brigadier General Michael McDaniel. Also, have you ever thought about raising your own chickens? Well, this weekend at Hunter Park Garden House, they're hosting a workshop to teach you everything you need to get started raising a flock in your own backyard. We'll speak with workshop instructor Corey Jason to find out more. That and more tomorrow on Current State. It's also a live music Friday. Keep that in mind. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. Hope you can join us Friday. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR.